From Ground Zero Radio, this is Democracy Now in Exile. Is an attack on Afghanistan imminent? NATO says the U.S. has presented clear and compelling evidence that links Osama bin Laden to last month's attacks, but won't disclose the proof. We'll review the FBI investigation so far with two British journalists who've had unprecedented access to FBI files. Also, the Justice Department jails hundreds of people on minor traffic and immigration violations and arrests more than a dozen on no charges at all. We'll talk about their cases. And a Northern Ireland reporter is shot to death by loyalist paramilitaries as the IRA struggles to distance itself from global terrorism. All that and more coming up on Democracy Now! In Exile's War and Peace Report. Welcome to the War and Peace Report, broadcasting just blocks from where the towers of the World Trade Center once stood. I'm Amy Goodman. NATO's Secretary General said today the United States has given clear and compelling evidence that Osama bin Laden is involved in last month's attacks on the United States. But the NATO secretary refused to elaborate on the information provided by U.S. Ambassador Francis X. Taylor, who's President Bush's coordinator for counterterrorism. The NATO secretary general said it must remain secret for now. Robertson's comments come ahead of a speech by British Prime Minister Tony Blair, expected to tell Afghanistan's Taliban rulers that time has run out for handing over bin Laden. U.S. House negotiators yesterday agreed to give the government unprecedented new authority to investigate and detain what it calls terrorist suspects, a bipartisan compromise that was assailed by civil libertarians as a blow to American values, even as it was criticized by the Bush administration for not going far enough. In the most controversial measure approved by negotiators, the government would be allowed to detain any foreigners suspected of terrorist activity for up to 7 days without filing charges or giving them an opportunity to ask a judge to release them. That would apply both to legal immigrants and those in the country without documentation. But even after the 7 days, the Attorney General John Ashcroft would have power to detain foreigners until they're deported as long as he has reasonable grounds to believe, that's quote unquote, that they may be involved in terrorism. The new legislation would also make it easier for law enforcement officials to obtain wiretaps. Law enforcement officials would be able to get court orders allowing them to retrieve records of emails and other electronic communications, not just telephone records, as current law allows. Former National Security Advisor Robert McFarlane, a key figure in the Iran-Contra scandal, is pressing the Bush administration to support replacing the Taliban with a government headed by Afghanistan's former king. McFarlane has joined with multimillionaire options trader Joseph Ritchie of Chicago to urge the Bush administration to support a new Afghan government headed by 86-year-old former ruler King Mohammad Zahir Shah. McFarlane and Ritchie met with Deputy National Security Advisor Steve Hadley at the White House on Friday to promote the idea. Ritchie became known in Washington as one of the first U.S. businessmen to invest in the Soviet Union before communism fell. Ritchie hired a Washington lobbying firm in March to help him promote the idea. In the Iran-Contra affair, McFarlane pleaded guilty to 4 counts of withholding information, but was later pardoned by the first President Bush. The scandal involved covert operations, shipments of missiles to Iran in exchange for that country's assistance in freeing hostages held in the Mideast, and a secret illegal resupply of Nicaraguan Contra rebels after Congress ended military aid. The British government has retreated over its proposal to introduce compulsory identity cards as part of emergency anti-terrorist legislation now being drafted. Civil servants are working around the clock to draft an emergency bill that would include speeding up extradition procedures and banning people suspected of terrorist links from claiming political asylum in Britain. Yesterday, civil liberties groups said they were delighted at the backdown by the government and claimed it was a result of a powerful public and political backlash. but they said their campaign would not end until ID cards had been permanently ruled out. A cross-party coalition of MPs, religious leaders, and police officers published a stinging indictment of ID cards yesterday, claiming they would not aid the international fight against terrorism. Yesterday, delegates at the Labour Party conference in Brighton expressed concern that their introduction would inflame racial prejudice in Britain. French police have admitted that they're twice as likely to ask for papers from young men of North African origin as they are from their white counterparts. Desperately needed food aid began flooding into Afghanistan yesterday as humanitarian agencies raced against time to boost warehouse stocks before a breakout of hostilities and the onset of winter. Even as the threat of imminent U.S. military strikes intensifies, UN World Food Program officials said convoys are rolling into the country from Pakistan, Tajikistan, and Turkmenistan with nearly 1,500 tons of wheat for an estimated 8 million Afghans in need of emergency assistance. The massive humanitarian operation shifted into high gear after an experimental convoy arrived safely in Kabul yesterday. All aid shipments were stopped and foreign aid workers pulled out of Afghanistan after the September 11th attacks in the United States. UN Secretary General Kofi Annan has appealed for $584 million for donors to avert a humanitarian catastrophe in Afghanistan, where millions face starvation. And India's state of Kashmir appealed to the United States to help following a suicide bomb attack on the state assembly, which killed 34 people. A state government spokesperson said the region is urging Washington to extend its war on terrorism to target Islamic militants fighting against Indian rule in Kashmir, the country's only Muslim-majority state. We'll have more on India and on Gandhi's birthday, which is today, in the second hour of our two-hour War and Peace report for those stations that stay with us for the second hour.
I saw the plane hit the building, the flame and the billowing smoke. I saw the glass, metal, paper, and stone. Everything shattered and broke. I was there with my people, Engine Company 24. We marched into the building, got as far as the 35th floor. The black smoke and the heat was like nothing I'd seen in all of my years. With each step in that blazing inferno, you could feel destiny near. Amidst all of the falling girders, the sheetrock and God knows what else, I tried to find the survivors, those who made it to the stairwells. I carried the wounded to safety, if that's what you might call the street. With bodies and boulders and rubble all crashing down at your feet. As number two was collapsing, when only 10 floors still stood, everything was falling around like it was made out of cardboard and wood. That's when I heard someone trapped underneath the debris. I started pulling at something, and that's when the fire got me. I was pinned beneath the rubble, the flames were licking my coat, and the pain, the unbearable agony. And then that was all that she knew. But I just wish I could tell you before I am taken away. that I've seen a lot of this world, and there's something that I gotta say. I don't believe in politics, I believe in the human race. I believe in the goodness of people in New York or some faraway place. I believe in my daughter, and I believe in my wife. And ain't nobody's father be taken to avenge the loss of my life. Some people may call me a brave man, and this may very well be, but the firefighters of Kabul are just as brave men as me.
David Rovix, live in the firehouse with us of Engine 31 in Chinatown, just blocks from the rubble, where hundreds of firefighters and other emergency workers continue to comb through the debris. No live person has been brought out in more than a week. You are listening to Democracy Now! in Exile's War and Peace Report, and you can hear more of David's songs at davidrovics.com, R-O-V-I-C-S. He'll be with us for the full 2 hours of the War and Peace Report. Well, NATO Secretary General Lord Robertson announced today that the United States had presented clear and compelling evidence that points, quote, conclusively to involvement of Osama bin Laden and his al-Qaeda network in last month's attacks in New York and Washington. Following a classified briefing given to the NATO's ruling council by U.S. Ambassador-at-Large Francis X. Taylor, Robertson said, quote, it's clear that all roads lead to al-Qaeda and pinpoint Osama bin Laden as having been involved. He also said the allies have determined that the attack was directed from abroad and therefore covered by NATO's Article 5, which says that an attack on one member is an attack on all. The announcement's the clearest sign yet that an attack on Afghanistan is imminent. But the clear and compelling evidence linking bin Laden to the September 11th attacks has not been made public. To review the evidence so far, we're joined right now by journalists Chris Blackhurst and Paul Lashmar, who wrote an extended piece on the FBI investigation in the British Sunday Independent. The piece begins, investigators now say they've pieced together more or less the whole jigsaw of the plan to attack America, but are missing one vital ingredient, a firm, compelling link with Osama bin Laden. We're joined by Paul Lashmar and Chris Blackhurst. Paul Lashmar, can you talk about this point? I mean, you have your British Prime Minister, Tony Blair, right now addressing the country. NATO now saying they've got the evidence. But what is it?
What is it? Well, they don't tell us, is the honest answer. One presumes this is because it will be telephone tap-in operations on a global scale. As I understand it, the National Security Agency in the States collects a lot of this material and then can listen to it retrospectively. It may not have identified in the build-up to September the 11th what was going on, but now can look back at that material and get a sense of what was going on in a way that they couldn't before. They can now see a pattern that perhaps wouldn't have been obvious at the time. Now, what that, of course, contains, we don't know. It's being kept secret, and that's, you know, the fact that they are keeping the secret suggests it is wiretaps, not other kinds of intelligence.
How did you get unprecedented access to the FBI files?
Well, we've both got very good contacts. I work the British end, and Chris worked the US end. And we've, you know, got a good perspective on what has been going on.
Well, Chris Blackhurst, as you were looking at the evidence here, you talk about the planning in a Hamburg student flat 18 months ago to the destruction of the Twin Towers and the hunt for the killers. Can you make your way back from September 11th after the plane struck the buildings in New York and Washington? What did the FBI do? How did they start to piece it all together?
They actually started very quickly, and they had some very early success. I mean, what they did was what they do very very well. They went right back through all the records of everybody on the flight, and it was very easy for them at that stage to identify who the hijackers were. They've not moved at all from the original 19. I mean, very early on, they identified the 19 hijackers, and they've always stuck with that. And really, they worked flat out, going right back through all the credit card payments and following the trail of the money. And from that, they were able to get back to Hamburg and to Mohammed Atta and his student flat. But that's really what they were doing. I mean, they traced all the car rental, all the hotel rooms where the people stayed.
Before we get back to Atta and the Hamburg flat, what about the 20th hijacker? Apparently, there were supposed to be 20. There were only 19.
Yeah, they're absolutely certain that there was supposed to be a 20th called Zacharias Musayu. I think that's how his name's pronounced. He was picked up in August in Minnesota because he made his flight instructor suspicious. He wasn't interested in learning how to land an aircraft. It would fit in, this is the FBI theory, that there were 20 hijackers, there were five on each plane. There was going to be one experienced pilot on each plane, and the other four were there to take care of the crew. Why the hijackers went ahead knowing that one of them had actually been arrested, I don't know. I mean, the word from the FBI is that the 20th hijacker is refusing to cooperate. Presumably they were confident, the hijackers, that he wouldn't talk.
But how do they know he is a part of this crew? I mean, I guess that's the standard issue here. We are so much accepting what the authorities say without knowing what the evidence is.
Oh, there's no doubt that Zacharias Musayu has a background in this area. His mother became very worried about his extremist Muslim views. He is connected with various people in the Al-Qaeda organization, and there's no question that he was up to something. What it was, they're not sure, but it would fit. They now know, to their horror, what it probably was that he was going to be involved with.
Paul Lashmar, yes. Take us to the Hamburg flat.
The Hamburg flat appears to be where the first staging post for the operation. At the moment, the evidence suggests that the group of hijackers were led by Mohammed Atta and two other men, and they conducted the absolute, day-to-day running of the operation. They planned and put it into position and then moved to the United States and made it work. Now, the question that's arising is, did they operate alone, or was there other figures behind them that suggested this operation and gave them an approximate time and place to do it, which is a typical Al-Qaeda position?
Who was Mohammed Atta?
Well, he was probably the oldest, as I recall, of the hijackers, a 33-year-old Egyptian. He's quite well-educated, not a particularly attractive personality by all accounts, a man who'd become quite immersed in quite a fundamentalist form of Islam. And we don't, I think, yet know much about how his mind was working in the years before he starts to implement this plan sometime in late 1999.
Looking at today's paper's reports, it says that Osama bin Laden himself may have supplied a piece of evidence linking him to the September 11th attacks. Foreign intelligence officials say they intercepted a telephone call on September 9th between bin Laden and the woman who reared him as a child. This according to a report by NBC, which said, in 2 days, you're going to hear big news and you're not going to hear from me for a while. He said this, according to the news report. The Justice Department declined to comment on the report. Investigators also now believe a financier connected to bin Laden in the United Arab Emirates funneled undetermined amounts of money into the bank accounts of the hijackers. Financial records indicate at least $100,000 was sent by wire transfer from Pakistan to two Florida bank accounts used by Mohammed Atta. How realistic do you think that account is of a phone call being intercepted between
it's
bin Laden.
It's perfectly plausible, but whether it's the accuracy of it, I really cannot comment. I don't know how accurate that journalist's information is, and therefore, it sounds slightly unlikely, but you never know. But there is undoubtedly the funding. You come to the funding. There is obviously money going into this group. There is external involvement. They didn't do this without some kind of financial and, if you like, policy. A group. There's something behind this. There's a policy that's in place. Now, the thing that concerns me is the notion of always coming back to bin Laden, because bin Laden is obviously a very serious and major figure in all of this. But the desire to have him as a sort of great Satan in his own right, that the Mr. Big, I worry that this will distort the whole process of the evidence. You've got the evidence coming from the hijackers and you move back. And the natural thing is to do is to, bear in mind that bin Laden may well figure in this, is to follow the leads where they go. But there seems to be this enormous compulsion to demonstrate that bin Laden was the Mr. Big behind this. And no one else could have done it. That may fundamentally give us a misinterpretation of the actual events, how these kinds of people work and what goes through their minds, and that actually this is a collective spirit with some major figures in it rather than a Mr. Big controlling this evil network.
We have to break for stations to identify themselves. We're talking to Paul Lashmar and Chris Blackhurst. They are two journalists with the British newspaper The Independent who've had unprecedented access to FBI files, and in their most recent piece have investigated the FBI evidence to date. You're listening to The War and Peace Report. Back in a minute.
Judge, he went wild over me. I could plainly see that we would never agree. So I let the man obey what his conscience had to say. He went wild, simply wild over me. And that jailer, he went wild over me. And he locked me up and threw away the key. Well, it seems to be the rage, so they throw me in a cage. They go wild, simply wild over me.
You're listening to Democracy Now in Exile's War and Peace Report. David Rovics, our musician, in the firehouse here in Chinatown, just blocks from where the recovery and search operation is going on to date. Police checkpoints all outside of our building as they continue to check the vehicles that drive down Lafayette, so close to where the World Trade Center once stood. We're talking to Paul Lashmar and Chris Blackhurst, two reporters with the British newspaper The Independent. After that, we're going to find out about the more than 400 people who have been detained in this country. And then we'll talk about Northern Ireland and the journalist who was gunned down on Friday night and what the Sinn Féin and IRA are doing in light of the current investigations. But Chris Blackhurst, going back to the evidence at this point, how did the men who are in this country, who are believed to be the hijackers who died in the suicide attacks, get identification here?
Quite simply, I mean, you have to remember that in several cases, they actually had bona fide papers. When they didn't, they were quite easily able to buy them. And I think what this case has uncovered, and really it's a question for the U.S. authorities, is the ease by which people are able to acquire false papers. And in the case of at least two of them, they approached a group of guys in a car park in Virginia, took them off to an attorney's, and they actually swore in front of the attorney that they knew them and they knew where they lived. And this really uncovers a whole industry of false papers, people able to supply false papers, false IDs, people who are prepared to swear that they know people, they know where they live, and that's how they did it.
This was a man named Herbert Villalobos?
Yes, that's right.
And why would they have vouched for these men who just came up to them in a parking lot?
Well, I assume, and I don't know this, I assume that Herbert Villa-Lobos was actually paid or money changed hands. There seems to be a whole underground trade in supplying false papers.
If this was Osama bin Laden, who is the closest person to bin Laden that the FBI and international authorities have traced these men to?
They're saying, and to date we haven't got a name, we haven't got names. They have been saying that four of the hijackers had been to his camps in Afghanistan. Now, so far, as far as I'm aware, they've not given out any names. And they're keeping that very close to their chest. I'm not sure why. I'm not sure why they're so sensitive about that. I think as well. Sorry?
I didn't say anything, but I was going to ask you, who is Zawahiri?
Who is?
Zawahiri.
Zawahiri is his deputy. He is the man that I think a lot of people suspect as having organized this. He has a history of quite outrageous acts of terrorism. And I think the suggestion that's been made all along is that bin Laden is in hiding in Afghanistan. The Taliban have said all along that they believe that bin Laden, that he did not have the means to organize this. And I think a lot of attention has been focusing on his deputy, who is a very good organizer. He goes by the nickname, he's called in the terrorist world, they call him the doctor. And he is in fact a trained doctor, and he is in fact bin Laden's doctor. But he is always thought to be the person capable of organizing this.
Now, he's already an indictment in the United States for the embassy bombings in Kenya and Tanzania. Mm. You then have Khalid Almidar. Can you explain who he is?
Khalid Almidar, he is another bin Laden associate. I mean, you have to remember, I think one thing, that I think something that Paul Ashmar said earlier, and I agree with this entirely, one of the things that is quite dangerous in all this, it has been the rush of the authorities to pinpoint everything on bin Laden. I mean, he has got a whole network of people. And by purely going for bin Laden, they could end up missing all these others. There's a whole raft of people who passed through Al-Qaeda, who know bin Laden, who share his same views. And, you know, it quite frankly, it could have been any one of these people who organized it.
Now, this man, Almidar, suspected of being a hijacker on American Airlines Flight 77, which hit the Pentagon, you both write, was filmed by the CIA in Kuala Lumpur in January last year, meeting a suspect in the bombing of the USS Cole, an attack that was attributed to bin Laden. Paul Lashmar, how solid is the evidence linking the USS Cole attack to bin Laden?
Well, again, it's the network. I mean, it's undoubtedly the same group and a number of prominent players. Whether bin Laden was the mastermind behind it or is just a major player in it, of course, is the question at hand. You know, it's that linkage that you've got endless people. Well, not endless. There is a group of about 10 people who seem to be major players around bin Laden. But is he really the big figure that he has played, or are there a group spread across much of North Africa and elsewhere who are, you know, behind a number of concerted attacks? Because one of the things we've seen in the last 3 weeks is the realization of just the huge number of attacks that are being orchestrated at any one time and are being played out in all sorts of places across the world. You only have to look up, for instance, the press on the Indian subcontinent to see a large number of what are described as terrorist attacks every day. It's just quite extraordinary, and it stretches over to the Philippines, just a wide-ranging group of people.
I mean, it's interesting you say that about the Indian subcontinent. Someone was just saying you all are dealing with these attacks here in the United States, that there have been a series of bombings in India that have been attributed to Al-Qaeda.
Yes.
And sometimes people say, you know, how do you find suicide bombings? But you just count the number of young Palestinians who have been prepared to do that. The numbers are, you know, something like there's 20 or 30 attacks in the last several years. They are so disillusioned and in such despair that they're prepared to do this. And there are ready recruits.
What about the issue of bioterrorism? In the tabloids in the United States now, the big headlines, bioterror. With the people that you've been looking at, the FBI has been looking at, and British intelligence, what use have they made? And we know what use that states have made, and the U.S. Among them, in developing biological weapons. What about individual actors?
Well, there are a number of cases on record of dubious individuals trying to access biological, chemical, and nuclear materials with the purpose of what they're going to use them for is obviously suspicious. But we've been lucky so far; no one has done that, with the exception, of course, the Japanese case. Although that in itself was there was a surprisingly small loss of life under the circumstances. Used in sarin, but it's very hard to judge this. I mean, in the fear and panic that has followed September 11th, it looks all too possible, and it is possible. But I think as the weeks go by, people are being slightly more realistic and saying that there's a fairly small chance of this occurring. But of course, everybody's frightened to say that because if it does happen, they're going to look completely stupid. But at the moment, with a weapon like an airplane, there doesn't seem much need for biological and chemical warfare, which is actually, by and large, quite a difficult thing to control and use successfully. I mean, we've now seen what a fully loaded aircraft will do. It's the equivalent of atomic explosion. And it's much more readily accessible. So, I think that what we're unfortunately likely to see is more repetitions of that than biological and chemical warfare.
As we wrap up, about how many people have been arrested around or detained around the world now since September 11th by authorities in Spain and Britain, in Germany, in the United States, that are believed to be involved with this?
Chris, do you want to take that one?
What was the question?
How many people? Like, you talk about some 40 suspected members of these networks have been arrested.
350, I believe.
Yeah, 350 in the States.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And in Britain, the MI5 and MI6, how are they involved?
I think there's one key difference between the people under arrest in Britain, certainly most of the people under arrest in Britain, and the people who've been swept up in the States. And that is that the ones under arrest in Britain are very, very widely thought to have been al-Qaeda terrorists and to have been linked to them. And you have to remember that in the case of several of the people under arrest in Britain, they were already in jail before the 11th September attacks. They have arrested people since, but certainly in this country, the authorities, they seem to be quite confident that the senior people were already in jail. But they are, continuing to arrest people. They arrested somebody in London yesterday who was suspected of being involved on the financial side, and certainly across Europe, all the time, people are being picked up.
Finally, does it make you nervous as journalists to be talking about all of these, quote, terrorists who have been picked up, when what you have to rely on are the words, the statement of the authorities?
Do you mean it make in
that you're going on what the state says?
Yes, it does. I mean, there's no question in my mind that we're not being told the whole story. I do find it very, very odd, for instance, today that the NATO ambassadors have been briefed, and yet the whole briefing is top secret. I mean, why? You just don't know. We don't know if we're being told the truth. It's quite, in that sense, it's quite scary. And I think what does scare me, and it's something that Paul Ashmar mentioned earlier, is the way that from the very moment the towers fell, the way that the whole exercise has been geared towards bin Laden. I hope for everybody's sake that it is that in a sense that he was involved, because in that sense they might actually get the right person. But there's so many of these people out there, I just worry that in fact they're going to miss somebody, but we don't know.
Or pick up the wrong people.
That brings us back to the oversight question, is that I think this shows that we still do not, and particularly in Britain, have adequate oversight where we feel that independently minded people are allowed access to intelligence material to judge whether it's compelling and accurate. I know that there's been moves in the United States over the years, and that's headed in the right direction. But we have a tremendous sense that we don't really know what they're looking at or what they're going, and we're not confident that they've, on the past record, that they're necessarily making the right judgment.
I think that's the point. I think certainly in this country, the whole history of British intelligence has been littered with mistakes.
And the question is, does bombing help advance this kind of investigation?
Oh, well, sure. I mean, my fear of bombing is it will only encourage more of these people to go and kill themselves in yet more suicide bombings.
Well, on that note, I want to thank you both for being with us. Paul Lashmar and Chris Blackhurst have had unprecedented access to FBI files to journalists with the British newspaper The Independent, and we hope to be speaking with them again soon. A little music break from David Rovics live in our Firehouse studios in the garret of Firehouse in Chinatown, right near where the World Trade Center once stood. And then we're going to talk to some lawyers about those who have been arrested, hundreds of people here in the United States.
I'm as mild-mannered man as can be. Ain't done nobody harm that I can see. Still on me they put a ban. They would throw me in the can. They go wild, simply wild over me. Yeah, they accuse me of rascality. I don't know why they're always picking on me. I'm as gentle as a lamb, yet they take me for a ram. They go wild, simply wild over me.
You are listening to the War and Peace Report. In its vast investigation, the Justice Department's jailing hundreds of people on minor traffic and immigration violations, and is even arresting more than a dozen people, material witnesses, on no charges at all. The Justice Department said last week at least 480 people have been detained. Little information has been released about them. Meanwhile, House negotiators agreed to give the government new authority to investigate and detain people, a bipartisan compromise that denied the Bush administration some powers it sought, but that was assailed by civil libertarians as a blow to American values. Under an agreement, authorities would be able to hold any foreigner without charges for as long as a week. The anti-terrorism legislation would also expand the government's wiretapping and internet surveillance powers in such cases. Gene Butterfield is with us, executive director of the American Immigration Lawyers Association, and Mark Vanderhut, immigration attorney in San Francisco, who represents the LA-8. Gene Butterfield, tell us, with these latest numbers, can you summarize the charges against the hundreds of people who've been detained?
Well, Amy, I think part of the problem is that we don't know if these people have even been charged yet. In his press conference late last week, Attorney General Ashcroft talked about the 480 being detained currently, and he said 130 of those were being detained on suspected immigration violations. That can be anything from being out of status as a student to having overstayed a visitor visa, to the fact that you might be a lawful permanent resident with a green card here fully legally, but you are suspected of committing or being involved in a terrorist activity, which can make you deportable. So it's a very wide net that's been cast. And with the powers that Ashcroft instituted by regulation a couple of weeks ago, he can continue to hold these people for, quote unquote, any reasonable period of time before even deciding whether to bring any immigration charges against them at all.
Mark Vanderhut, you represent this group known as the LA-8. Can you describe who they are and why their case is relevant here?
Sure, Amy. Well, I've been representing the LA-8 on behalf of the National Lawyers Guild now for probably 15 years. And this is a case that I think has very important lessons for what's going on now. The FBI initially did an investigation of Palestinian...
Are you by any chance on a speakerphone?
No, I'm not. Are you having trouble?
Oh, yeah, just as, if you could speak as loud as you can.
Okay, hold on one second. How's that? Is that better?
Much better.
Okay. The FBI did an investigation of Palestinians. It happened to be around the 1984 Olympics in the Los Angeles area. They found out about Khadr Hamidi, Michelle Shahadeh, and other individuals who eventually became the LA 8, found out they were doing political work advocating for Palestinian rights in a Palestinian state, decided to investigate them. They had the FBI live next door, two of them undercover for 3 years. They did Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act wiretaps against them. They did every investigative tool they could find for 3 years, and at the end of that investigation found out that they had done nothing illegal, were only involved in lawful support of Palestinian rights, and then said to the FBI, I'm sorry, to the INS, well, can you figure out any way to get rid of them because we don't like what they're doing? The INS then used the immigration laws, and some of these people, as Gene mentioned, were elected today lawful permanent residents of the United States, been here legally for many years. But the United States tried to use the immigration laws at that time, the McCarran-Walter Act, the law that said you could deport people who believed in communism, and they tried to deport them for that. We got that law declared unconstitutional, and then Congress passed what is the essence of today's laws. People can be deported for material support to an organization that's engaged in terrorist activity. And we didn't have a problem with that law, except what the INS tried to do in the LA-8 case was essentially do the same thing they had done under McCarran-Walter Act. They said, we know you haven't done anything illegal yourself, but you've raised money for hospitals, daycare centers, schools, etc., run by the PFLP. The PFLP also engages in military activity, which we now define as terrorist activity, and therefore you've provided material support to a terrorist organization, and you're deportable for that. This case has been going on close to 15 years now, and the LA-8 is still fighting its case. It's been up to the federal courts back many times, including the Supreme Court, and the government has pushed its case. Why? They publicly said to try to establish the precedent that they can deport lawful immigrants in the United States for purely lawful support for organizations that also have a military component to it. And that's what we're afraid is going on here, that lots of people are being rounded up who have absolutely done nothing illegal, but the FBI is using the INS and saying, is there any way you can get rid of them under the immigration laws? And that's what's very frightening about what the scale of the arrests have been.
The FBI director, Robert Mueller, met with leaders of the American Civil Liberties Union who are expressing concern about governmental overreach as they talked about who is being arrested, how they're being held. The FBI last week released another person who'd been detained as a material witness, an Antonio radiologist, Albader Al-Hazmi. His lawyer said his client was held incommunicado after his arrest as a material witness shortly after the assault. At one point, it took 6 days for lawyers to win access to him.
Mm-hmm.
How typical is this, Jean Butterfield?
I think it's very typical. You know, Al-Hazmi had the presence of mind to say that he would be willing to talk to the FBI, but he wanted to talk to his lawyer first. So he actually knew that he had a right to see a lawyer. I think a lot of people being caught up in this sweep don't know that they have that right. And in the never-never world of immigration detention, before you are charged, it's very unclear whether you have any, you know, ironclad right to even contact or see a lawyer. And I think we're very concerned that people aren't being given access, that they aren't being advised of the right, that they aren't being allowed their phone call. And like Al-Hazmi, he was taken from San Antonio to Minneapolis to New York City without ever being told where he was going and without being allowed to inform family members or his lawyer.
So at this point, do you expect to see more than 500 people arrested?
Yes. I mean, Attorney General Ashcroft, in testimony at the Senate and at the House last week, said at that point they had arrested 352 and they were looking for another 392. And those are specific people they're looking for. So he's already saying that they're planning to arrest nearly 800 people. They've done 480 to date, so I imagine they're still looking for another 300 or so.
Well, in the coming days, we're going to be looking extensively at the students, student records that are being pulled all over the country of Arab Americans, Muslim Americans, South Asian students. And I thank you very much to both of you for joining us. We've been joined by two lawyers who know well what it means for their clients to be taken, arrested, investigated. Mark Vanderhut, immigration attorney in San Francisco, and Gene Butterfield, executive director of the American Immigration Lawyers Association. When we come back from our break, we're going to talk about Northern Ireland, a reporter who was gunned down on Friday night. We're also going to look at Sinn Féin and the IRA in the wake of the attacks. You're listening to the War and Peace Report.
In 1803, we sailed out to sea, out from the sweet town of Derry, for Australia bound. If we didn't all drown, the marks of our fetters we carried. In the rusty iron chains, we sighed for our wains, our good women we left in sorrow. As the mainsails unfurled, our curses we hurled on the English and thoughts of tomorrow. Oh, I wish I was back home in Derry. Oh, I wish I was back home in Derry.
David Rovix, live in the studio with us here. Democracy Now! In Exile's War and Peace Report, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. As the world focuses on global terror attacks, Northern Irish leaders are struggling to distance the region from terror movements. During a Sinn Féin conference this weekend in Dublin, Gerry Adams, the leader of Sinn Féin, the political party allied with the Irish Republican Army, made a point of calling terrorism ethically indefensible. And yesterday, Ulster Unionist leader David Trimble called on the government to match its freezing of alleged Taliban assets in Britain with a crackdown on the profits made by paramilitary groups in Northern Ireland. Trimble's statements follow the murder last Friday of Northern Ireland investigative journalist Martin O'Hagan, who worked in the Belfast office of the Dublin-based Sunday World newspaper and covered paramilitary and drug-related stories. O'Hagan was shot from a passing car as he walked home with his wife from a pub in County Armagh, 25 miles from Belfast. His wife wasn't injured. Yesterday, Protestant extremists claimed responsibility for the killing. Martin O'Hagan was the first reporter killed in more than 30 years of strife in Northern Ireland. In a statement to the BBC in Belfast, a pro-British cover group called the Red Hand Defenders claimed responsibility for the killing, saying it had shot O'Hagan for crimes against the Loyalist people. Authorities say the Ulster Defense Organization has used the Red Hand Defenders as a cover name when admitting to recent bomb attacks, such as the sectarian murders of two teenagers in July. O'Hagan's work often exposed the criminal underbelly of paramilitary organizations. He had infuriated paramilitary bosses and received death threats from the Loyalist Volunteer Force in the past. Recently, he'd been working on a number of stories involving the Loyalist Volunteer Force members. We're joined now by Jack Holland, who is author of several books on the conflict in Northern Ireland, including Hope Against History, The Course of Conflict in Northern Ireland. Welcome to Democracy Now! In Exile. Can you tell us a little more about Martin O'Hagan?
As you work for a tabloid newspaper, as you pointed out, called the Sunday World, and for about, I guess, 15 or slightly more than 15 years, he was investigating the overlap between paramilitary groups on the Protestant side and their there are quite a few of those, and a sort of the criminal underworld, and the two at some points actually intersect, particularly after 1994, when the current peace process in the north of Ireland started. These groups, including the Irish Republican Army, went on ceasefire, but in the Protestant side, it seems that some of the organizations have turned from being politically motivated, if you like, to becoming almost like sort of mafia organizations whose main purpose would be to fund themselves through the importation of drugs, including heroin, ecstasy, and cocaine.
This is all happening in the midst of the September 11th attacks, and Tony Blair, I believe, is speaking as we're on air right now, talking about the U.S. And allied forces about to attack. How does he deal with these forces who are loyal to Britain in his own backyard?
Well, first of all, he would dispute that they're loyal to Britain, and the description of them as pro-British, I think, is really inaccurate in the sense that they receive no government support. Their allegiance is to the United Kingdom. They don't want that part of Ireland to become part of an independent Irish state. But they're not so much pro-British as anti-independence. I mean, they have attacked British officers. They've attacked policemen. In fact, the group that killed Martin O'Hagan, the Red Hand Defenders, one of the first people that it killed about two, three years ago was a police officer whom it killed with a bomb. So they're quite prepared to attack the forces of law and order if they get in the way of their particular aims. So to say they're pro-British really would probably be a bit too general. I mean, they see themselves as that, but in fact, they're often just as violent against the forces of law and order as the Irish Republican Army has been.
Although there's been a lot of investigation and links between paramilitary forces and the British occupying forces.
Yes, there have been allegations of collusion between the police force in the north of Ireland and certain paramilitary organizations. But, I mean, having investigated those allegations for many years myself, I admit that in a certain way, there is a kind of overlap because the police, like the Protestants, come from the same section of the community, from the same part of the community. So there's bound to be, at some point, sympathy between certain individuals in the security forces and members of these paramilitary groups. But I've yet to find evidence of a systematic form of collusion which would run into the higher ranks of the police force.
There is an interesting corollary to what is going on right now in Northern Ireland with the newly established National Homeland Security Department that the governor of Pennsylvania is going to head, Tom Ridge, and websites. We're joined on the phone now by John McDonough, who is my colleague at WBAI in New York when we were broadcasting from there. And John does a program called Radio Free Erin on Saturdays. His website has now been shut down as of last Friday. John, can you tell us about this?
More or less, we could say it almost started, you could say, 6 months ago when the Bush administration put certain Irish groups on a terrorist watch list. There was a website run by the 32-county sovereignty committee in this country. They pulled it down automatically as not to have the government come after them. But last Thursday, I got a call from the CEO of CosmicRadio.net saying his lawyer had got a call from the IP server stating that they had to take down the site of IRAradio.com, that they were in fear of their assets being seized. Now, whether they were told by a government official or preempting the government, because the government hasn't yet stated what they consider terrorist groups and what they consider support for these terrorist groups. So what I think might have went on is that these groups, not waiting around for the government to come down and seize their assets, will preempt the government because they don't need the hassle or the court cases of fighting just to put up IRAradio.com, which is just archive shows of the show we do every Saturday on WBAI.
So what will happen now? And do you expect more websites to be shut down?
I would expect. I mean, if you're running a business and an internet provider service, and you see the government is claiming this group's a terrorist group, that group, these Muslims are terrorists, and you're hosting their website, you would probably act before even the government tells you to act or comes down and seizes your assets. So there is a general fear that's running throughout the country. What to do? Who's going to host what would be termed maybe radical sites or putting out different points of view? You know, it's a very dangerous time, and I just think most IPs would buckle rather than take on a huge court case during the political climate that's gone on since September 11th.
Jack Holland, can you talk about those connections in the wake of the attack?
Well, the attempts to suppress support for Republican organizations in the United States predates the World Trade Center disaster. In fact, the administration last summer, May or June, if my memory serves me correct, drew up a list of Republican organizations which are now illegal in the United States, either to support or to send money to, and these groups are connected, allegedly, to a splinter group of the IRA, which was responsible for one of the worst atrocities in the history of the Troubles, the Omaha bombing of 1998, in which 29 civilians were killed. I think Bush was responding to pressure from Blair in London to do something about what are, in fact, quite minuscule organizations in the United States that can be identified with supporting this particular organization.
Do you see things changing now in the wake of September 11th?
I think things have changed drastically. Not so much for the smaller organizations, of which Mr. McDonough is connected, to which he is connected, but I think for the big groups like Sinn Féin and the IRA, the mainstream IRA, particularly in relation to the issue of decommissioning. Now, the mainstream IRA is in possession of approximately 100 tons of weapons, which it got from Colonel Gaddafi in the 1980s. And I think it's going to come under extraordinary pressure to decommission those weapons by the Bush administration, who are in no mood to get into disputes about what is decommissioning and what isn't decommissioning under the current circumstances. So I expect they will have to move if they want to retain their support here in the United States.
John McDonough, final word. We just have 20 seconds.
No, like Jack said, I mean, the American government was moving on support groups here in this country long before September 11th. I mean, I just know myself with the surveillance with the FBI and wiretaps and everything like that that's going on. They're just going to have carte blanche now to go after any group, whether it could be Vieques or the Puerto Rican Independence Party, under the guise of what happened on September 11th.
Well, on that note, we do have to wrap up for this first hour of the program. In our next hour, we're going to be looking at Gandhi. It is his birthday, and looking at his philosophy with the spokesperson for the United Nations, who also is Indian and a Gandhi scholar. We are also going to go back to the protests of Washington and hear what people in the peace rallies had to say. I want to thank you all for being with us, Jack Holland and John McDonough. That does it for the program, Democracy Now! In Exile, produced by Chris Abrams, Brad Simpson, Miranda Kennedy, Anthony Sloan, our music maestro and engineer, Errol Maitland at the helm at WBIX.org. A very special welcome to the listeners of WFMU. It's great to have you with us. Special thanks to our video team, Chase Pearson, Tony Riddle, Rick Younger, Zoe No, Karen Renucci, Dee Dee Halleck, Lenny Charles, Sam Delgado, Orlando Richards, Rachel Jones, Tom Poole. Thanks to our tech team. And to Downtown Community Television, John Alpert and Keiko Tsuno. Thank you to the Pacifica stations, KPFA, KFCF, and all the affiliates. We are Pacifica. We're broadcasting in exile from the embattled studios of WBAI, from the studios of the Band and the Fired, from the studios of our listeners. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.